at this point, it's more signaling than them having announced something that's game-changing. Like, we can see they take what's happening seriously. They're trying to do something, and there probably is more in store. I think alone a reserve requirement cut is not going to change the direction of the Chinese economy, but perhaps it shows that they are willing to take action quicker than people thought.
Welcome, Jens. How's it going?
Good. It's nice to be in the office so we don't have to, you know, worry about the Zoom working and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's a nice change. How long are you over in the UK for?
Just a few days. I've been on a little bit of a tour to Denmark and different places in Europe, so a quick stop here in London.
Yeah, lovely. Well, we've caught you, again, probably at the perfect time to speak about China. That's going to be the focus of today's interview. I want to start by talking about the economy, and then we'll get into equity markets as we usually do. China's economic growth rate fell to a three-decade low. We heard that earlier on, 5.2% in the fourth quarter and full year in 2023, I believe. We first discussed China, I believe it was around March time in 2023. So I just want to catch listeners up on what's happened since that first discussion. Give us the overall economic situation in China.
Yeah. So about a year ago, everybody was pretty optimistic that China was going to finally emerge from this, you know, long COVID lockdown that they had.
Yeah.
The last one in the world that really had the reopening going on. And for a couple of months, there was definitely an impact of reopening, right? Retail activity came back, restaurant activity came back, and things normalized. And then relatively quickly, we saw it already in March, at the end of March, the sort of real-time indicators that we track started to peak out.
Yeah.
And then we've had really a period, second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter, really China struggling with lots of different things, but like confidence being under pressure, not really recovering in any structural way, and some new things happening with like foreign investors really doubting that China really is going to have this central role in supply chains that they've had, right? We got used to it sort of being just a default. If you want to have a big manufacturing base, it has to be in China.
Yep.
And a lot of investors, and when I say investors, I mean both corporations that had to build that production capacity, but also obviously portfolio investors really have been rethinking how they're exposed to China. And it's been a big thing. So there's a confluence of different things. The real estate situation in China is still structurally difficult right after many, many years of overbuilding. So like multiple challenges that China is facing. And for the first time, really, since I started my career, I just walked through Fleet Street on the way to this meeting, right? My first job was to be an economist at Goldman. And this was when Goldman invented the BRICS concept, right? And China was the key country there. And really, since then, we've had a situation where global growth was driven by the Chinese cycle up until now.
Yeah.
And now it's like, okay, the U.S. is the key driver of the cycle, and what's happening in China really has gotten less attention. Investors are not as exposed. So it's quite a different regime.
Yeah, interesting. And we can talk on probably all of those points in due course. But before we move on, a reason for potentially that lack of exposure could be down to a lack of transparency in the data that the central regime lets out of the region.
Yeah.
I mentioned that 5.2% GDP growth figure. How reliable is the data coming out of the central regime in China at the moment?
Yeah, so I don't use Chinese official data really. Like we have a battery of alternative data that we look at that we trust more than the official GDP figures. And it's simpler than, you know, national accounting that you would do for all other countries, but simple is better in China's case, right? Because we've had many years where growth were always 6%, right? And we know the economy fluctuates more than that. Nobody can manage such a stable growth rate. So I don't think there's a lot of value in the official GDP statistics. And I think in terms of capturing what's actually going on in China, alternative data from China, and then what should we call it, cross checks from other economies is really the approach, right? So trade data from all the trading partner countries kind of serve as a cross check as to what's going on. So what that's what we're using. I would say the transparency issue that you're asking about goes beyond the economic data, right? Yeah. It also goes into what's happening in the corporate sector, right? So like 10 years ago, it was incredibly popular to think about, you know, the Chinese internet companies like Alibaba, Tencent, and so forth. And they had a big run-up. And now it's been literally one of the most disastrous investments, even though they are in the right sector, right? Like if you compare those companies with, you know, Google and Microsoft and Meta in the US, it's just an incredible divergence. And it's not because those companies are failing. It has a lot to do with investors just concerned that they are not private companies in the traditional sense. They're not capitalist run companies, and there's just a fundamental doubt as to whether they would be allowed to operate in a profit maximizing way, as we've seen already very concrete examples of, right? So that's making growth sectors are not valued as growth sectors are outside China.
Yeah. And before we move on to equities, I want to finish kind of setting the context and talking about the demographic picture in China. Mm-hmm. It's something that I saw on your X feed, I believe. There was a chart, we'll throw it up in the video, of working age population and how that was shrinking in China and how that obviously affects the macroeconomic picture in the region. Can you talk to us about what's happening on the demographic side?
Well, so when you look at the birth rates in China, like everybody knows that China had a one-child policy, right? And it was an official goal to try to slow down the population growth, right? But when you look at the birth numbers for the last couple of years, it's really quite shocking, right? Because the trends in demographic variables tend to be very slow-moving, right? Like fundamental decisions about having children, like it's not like, you know, red is fashionable this year, or like you change your clothing or something like that. Normally moves very slowly, but here it shifted quite abruptly, and I think that tells you a lot. In a way, it tells you more than the GDP statistics. And I think that the way to think about it is that it's really the confidence, the lack of confidence. Is showing up in a caution within families that is this the right time to expand the family, right? And a lot of people come to the conclusion that it's not. Obviously, there are special issues in China, right, that there's been a lot of focus on the education system being so high pressured that a lot of people don't feel it's worth it to go through it. And that also has an impact, right? But that's been the case for many years. That hasn't changed now. So there's something that's happened the last 2-3 years, the COVID shock, the economic downturn and so forth, that is really making families having second thoughts about expanding. And that's showing up there. And obviously that's going to have economic implications, right? So people like to compare China and India, right, the two most populous countries in the world. And we're definitely going to have divergence between those countries, right, where we still have rapid population growth in India and the Chinese population is going to start to shrink. And that's also going to have some impact. Like there are many, many reasons why corporations around the world are thinking about China differently, right? So there's clearly a geopolitical situation. We have severe tension between Western economies and China. But from a pure economics perspective, right, that we had a situation for many years where it almost seemed that there was like an infinite pool of labor, right? And that pool of labor initially was kind of exhausted from in a positive way, right, that they were put to work, right? But now they're put to work. The migration from the rural areas to urban areas kind of like almost progressed to a degree where it's not going on anymore. And then there's the long-term demographics. There's actually fewer and fewer young people coming into the labor market. And so that's also going to mean that, you know, big corporations that need to hire hundreds of thousands of people, it's not as easy as it used to be. There's not an infinite supply of those types of people, and it's going to have an impact. And as we know from different countries, Japan and so forth, right, once the demographic turns, it could definitely impact the psychology in a way that sort of permeates everything. And I think China's going to probably face that. If you think about having a situation where you've had overbuilding
in
real estate, right, and now you have less demand, fewer people coming in, that's going to make it harder to solve that problem. Like in the U.S., for example, we had overbuilding into the global financial crisis, right? And then the housing market corrected. But it's easier to have a correction if there's sort of underlying growth and demand from your population growing, right? And China's going to have an issue with that.
Okay, well, let's get on to how that picture is affecting capital flows, foreign investment.
Yeah.
We've seen weak China equity flows so far this year. Foreign investment outflows spiked last week. I saw again on the chart that you put up on your X feed. Talk to us about what's happening there, particularly in relation to China equity flows.
Yeah, so it's kind of like an ironic situation, right? Because China has been trying to open its capital markets for many years, right? And really the pattern, we can go back to the dates we discussed at the moment, going back to the second quarter of last year when the sort of reopening optimism started to peter out, we've had very, very weak capital flows.
Yeah.
And it's both in bond and equity space, right? So in bond space, there was a period into the COVID shock, right, where Chinese bond yields were the only ones that were sort of positive, where we went to the US, Europe, and so forth, Japan. We all had these zero bond yields pretty much. And we had a little bit higher in China, but that's flipped now, right? Because the Chinese interest rates never moved, and we moved from 0 to 5 in the United States, right? So on a relative basis, Chinese bonds became very unattractive just from a yield perspective, and then you put all the geopolitical concerns on top, and then you have actually seen like a very sustained trend of people getting rid of their Chinese bond exposure. And then in the equity space, you've had especially over the last 6 months, very persistent selling as well.
Yeah.
So there's a structural rethinking of the exposure people want to have to China and not wanting to have. And we've seen that very, very clearly across equities and bonds and foreign direct investment, which is like the physical capital that corporations have in place.
Yeah.
And you've literally seen selling, not just weak inflows, but actually people taking money out again.
Yeah. Yeah. And if we look then at the impact that's having on China's stocks and kind of the ETFs that track those instruments as well, I looked at the iShares China Large Cap ETF. That was down around 4.9% year to date. But interestingly, obviously, it's rebounded since Monday quite heavily. And that's off the back of China's central bank announcing new steps to boost bank lending. And that could be, or seems to be, part of a broader kind of bolstering of growth. Talk to us about what's happened already, and then perhaps you can explain what you expect to happen over the next few weeks.
Yeah, no, sure, you're absolutely right. So, like, obviously, check market reader screens all the time. So, I checked in and we were up like 2.8% or something in the different China related ETFs going into this meeting. And yeah, the explanation is that there's some kind of effort now to stop this slide, right? So it was already rumored yesterday that there's going to be an equity support fund of some type. There were big numbers mentioned, 2 trillion yuan. And there's been some official communication today that has put a little bit more meat on what's happening. But I think it's fair to say the plans are not spelled out yet, right? So it's a discussion that's ongoing. If they wanted to buy more than $200 billion worth, where's that money going to come from? That sounds like a lot. And I don't think it's totally clear, like, where is that going to be funded from and so forth. So I think this is a plan that's work in progress. It often happens like this when there's kind of like a panic in the market. We had like really a meltdown, right, with the Chinese indices underperforming U.S. stocks by 10% in a short period of time. So quite dramatic. It's often that type of price action that generates a policy response. And you often have, you know, the policy response being kind of half-baked because they have to rush it out, right? So they've leaked something that is only at a sort of very early planning phase. And it's not clear to me where the money is going to come from or whether the amounts that have been mentioned are really realistic. Like, there's been talk about this money coming from an offshore type vehicle, right? But there's not that many entities that have, you know, $200 billion in spare change sitting around. So, and I also, China lost a lot of foreign exchange reserves when they attempted to defend the currency in the mini crisis they had around 2015-16. So I'd be reluctant to, I think they would be very reluctant to spend more of those reserves. Like, they essentially had $4 trillion of reserves before that, and they spent $1 trillion, right? And I think since then, they've not really been touching them. They think, oh, okay, that's our really reserve that is there to boost confidence. If they start to spend that, it would be counterproductive. So it would have to come from somewhere else. And I think probably amounts are going to be bigger. Then we've had a reserve requirement cut overnight that is sort of more traditional monetary stimulus. Is that going to have a big impact? I think at this point, it's more signaling than them having announced something that's game-changing. Like, we can see they take what's happening seriously. Yeah. They're trying to do something. There probably is more in store. I think alone a reserve requirement cut is not going to change the direction of the Chinese economy, but perhaps it shows that they are willing to take action quicker than people thought, and we're going to have other things going on. Like, typically the way the Chinese economy has been managed has been not through interest rates like in other economies, but like there's some specific push to direct a certain quantity of loans, right, into certain sectors. And it would not be surprising if there's another push in that direction. But the challenge is that Chinese economy has big structural challenges, right? The real estate problem that they have is not an easy one to fix. I would say if you look at how markets are reacting, just looking very broadly, right, we have today, for the first time in a while, the market's kind of taking it seriously.
Yeah.
Because we've had so many false starts where, there's some little stimulus announcements and people have said, yeah, okay, we've heard that many times. But on this occasion, we've had, for example, copper prices move 2-3% quickly, which is how it felt in the old days that, okay, China's going to do something. It's going to have an impact on the industrial sector. So we've seen that. And we've even seen the dollar move. I think the dollar move we've seen today is a function of the news out of China. Like, the dollar's often sort of doing the reverse of the signal that comes out of China. If there is something positive happening for China, the dollar trades down. If there's something bad happening in China, the dollar trades up, right? And there is a little bit of optimism around China now, at least tactically, and the dollar has traded down in response, which is the first time in a while we've seen that. So crucial to watch whether they're going to follow through on these hints, these signals they're sending, and actually deliver something that's going to impact the economy. We updated all our real-time activity indicators in China into today. And it has been looking weak into January, right? So they need to do something to really make that momentum shift in a more positive direction.
Yeah, really interesting. I mean, without that news, we might have been talking about whether China equities were going to go find a new low, having been on a downward trend for some time. They've obviously ticked up as a result of the news, but do you see that as a short-term spike, or in the medium to long term, are we going to still head downwards for China equities, do you think?
Yeah, so I'm skeptical that they're going to be able to provide the support in the quantities that has been rumored. So I'm worried about some disappointment there. In general, also just, basing a view on an asset such as an equity market, not on fundamentals, but some government intervention, is typically quite risky. Yeah. So it really, for me to get conviction or confidence that this actually is something that can improve sentiment in a more sustainable direction, it have to be combined with actual economic policy, not just, you know, rescue operation for the equity market. And we haven't really seen that yet. So I think there's probably something in the works, right? But there's been stuff in the works for 9 months now, and we have not really seen anything come to fruition that was powerful. To be honest, there even this week we had a pretty prominent investment firm that went out of business. So I'm not saying anything that's secret. It was announced publicly, right?
Yeah.
And it was quite interesting. The explanation that was given by that Asian-focused firm kind of mirrors a lot of the thinking we've had around policy in China, and that has to do with kind of like an incoherent policy framework. Like the things that in the past would have triggered this action has not been happening, right? So that specific fund manager said, okay, I literally don't understand Chinese policy anymore. The reason why we made bad investment decisions was we used a template that has been working for decades, and now we just don't understand how policymakers are behaving. So I think it is a time to be humble and say, okay, there are things going on in terms of Chinese policymaking that is very unpredictable. And it's actually that unpredictable situation that is part of the investor uncertainty in itself, right? So they're going to try to break out of that, but we have not seen anything concrete, transparent. And I think if you want to, it's actually the transparency that is key here, right? If you want to gain confidence back, you need to put something concrete on the table rather than rumors and speculation and half-baked solutions, right? So it's kind of getting to the core of the problem here, that there's no forceful, transparent, easy to understand measures being taken. The logic is missing, right? Making everybody nervous. We have a bounce in the next couple of days, but we need something more tangible, logical, happening in order for investors to gain confidence again.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I just wanted to pick up on that incoherence point. You know, how sympathetic should we be to kind of policymakers in China about that incoherence? Is that just a function of kind of the problematic kind of wider macroeconomic environment that they find themselves in? Or is it actually kind of poor policymaking, poor strategy, as it were?
Well, I think we live in a world, we're meeting here in London, right, where the policy is set in a certain way. There's a certain interaction between, you know, what the public is thinking and what policies are eventually put in place. And there's also a certain interaction between markets and policy, like we had the Liz Truss example, right, where there was a policy announced. The market thought it was disastrous, and immediately we had essentially those policies were cancelled effectively, right? So China is different, and I don't think you can use that same framework, right? So for example, lots of economists would agree that one of the big problems in China is that consumption is too weak, right? So the sort of Western approach to solving that problem would be, okay, let's somehow make sure that the household sector has more purchasing power, right? Yeah. But there's an ideological opposition to providing funds to households. Yeah. So that solution has never been pursued, right? So the logic is different. And then there's also the issue about how decisions are made, right? So we clearly have a situation in China where decision-making is more centralized than it's been for a long, long time, some would be say since Mao. And that, I think, also means that the sort of typical mechanisms for making decisions are disabled to some degree. And we have, I wouldn't say it's one person that's making all decisions, but it's extremely concentrated. Yeah. And that means some of the logic we've used in the past is sort of circumvented as well and makes it pretty unpredictable. Like in economics, you often learn about there's some kind of, you know, utility fund. There's some goal you maximize to try to solve some kind of problem, right? But if you don't really know what it is the goal is that is being maximized for, then it's much harder to reach the correct conclusion.
Yeah, great. No, that's really interesting. And with all that in mind, then I want to move us on to the rate discussion. Were you surprised when China Central Bank recently obviously maintained its key policy rates? Help us understand the rationale there. That did cause some consternation amongst market commentators, but interested to get your reaction.
I think it's another example of the same, right? If you look at how monetary policy is set in the United Kingdom, US, Eurozone, like convertible currency countries, they're not exactly the same, but they have a very similar framework for setting policy, right? And in China, it's a bit different, right? In China, and actually we do need to focus on this because it's really important. In China, we have deflation now.
Yeah.
We have prices literally dropping. And in that situation, you would typically have a panic in a central bank. This is the worst situation for a panic because you have essentially, you know, unwanted tightening of financial conditions, because you can argue if you have deflation, right, inflation expectations are perhaps negative as well. That means that any given of nominal interest rates, call it 2, 2.5 in China, is actually very high real interest rates. So you actually have a situation today, right, where you can argue that in United States, real interest rates are in the region plus 2%. They used to be zero, right? But in China, if inflation expectations are negative, normal interest rates are 2.5. You actually have higher real interest rates in China than in the United States, even though you can argue that you need much, much lower real interest rates now. So that's the problem. And I think when you look at what's going on with rate setting and monetary policy in China, it's really like, it's almost like they have a goal in monetary policy that's just like stability. It's like, well, we just want to have stable interest rates. And it actually ends up overwhelming, like a more traditional, okay, we need to have stimulus, right? So it would seem logical that interest rates are going to go down, right? They have a real estate crisis. That's typically the situation where interest rates needs to go rock bottom, right? But their sort of psychological lower bound for interest rates is different from what we have elsewhere. But I think we can say with conviction, right, it's not going to be anytime soon when interest rates are going up in China, right? So it's just a matter of whether they get stuck at this level or whether they want to take them lower. And obviously that has potential to create even more of a wedge relative to the rest of the world, where we have interest rates much higher than we've had for a couple of decades.
Yeah, really interesting. That point around trying to maintain some sort of stability or equilibrium, I think was a word used in one of their recent policy announcements. That relates also, I suppose, to their currency. They use that word in relation to the currency in the most recent announcement. How difficult a challenge is it to retain some sort of stability or equilibrium in the yuan?
So certainly all the different challenges we've discussed around China have some kind of bearing on how easy it is to keep a stable currency. And they certainly would like to have a stable currency. And we can see it in our data as well, right, that they have been intervening in the currency markets over the last couple of months as well. Not in massive size. And part of the reason they can get away with not doing massive size is that they have other ways to control things, right? So if you think about Japan, that has also intervened in their currency market over the last year, they have a freely floating currency and free capital movement, right? So when they intervene, they have to do very big size, whereas in China, they might, try to talk to the importers or exporters to persuade people to transact in a different way. And you can actually see that in the currency market. If you look at, okay, what is the volume that has been going through the onshore CNY market? It's actually been quite low volume. So there's sort of a disconnect between, okay, there's something very bad happening in the economy. We can see from some of the capital flows that there's an appetite to get out, right? But at the same time, you don't have a lot of currency being traded. That doesn't really fit together. That kind of shows you that they're persuading different actors in the market to not really transact. And that allows them to control the currency with relatively moderate amounts. And they want to do moderate amounts because they don't want to leak more reserves, because they already lost a trillion too much back in 2015. But it doesn't mean the currency is in equilibrium. So they have like struggle, trying to stabilize the equity market, trying to not cut interest rates, trying to keep the currency stable. So it's very hard to solve all these things at the same time. We also end up in this situation where like the market doesn't really clear. So you actually sometimes prolong the pain this way, right? Sometimes you can have, okay, the equity market is going to go down a lot quickly and then it finds a bottom and it bounces. So one concern you can have with this equity market intervention actually prolongs the period where we are not really finding a bottom. So it's not so easy to control asset prices. That holds in China as it holds everywhere else.
Yeah. With that in mind, that makes complete sense to me. But if we look at the yuan and how that's performed since the most recent news where they announced, or it seems like they're going to kind of try and bolster growth, the currency recorded its biggest gain in 2 weeks yesterday. Is it a similar sort of picture than the one compared to the one that we imagined on the equity side? Is that going to be a short-term bounce and then medium to long-term? We expect it to resume the previous trend.
It's a little bit different in that like the equity market had this big kind of like a catastrophic decline, right? Whereas the currency has been kept more stable. So it's less volatile asset. I think that really is the main difference. Like the big picture kind of story around the currency, right, is that we have a ton of debate about, okay, what's the main reserve currency of the world? Is the dollar going to die? All these types of things, right? The reality is that the dollar has been very, very strong, generally strengthening essentially since 2014, right? So we've had a 10-year run in the dollar, but the dollar has been surprising a lot of people to the upside on a persistent basis.
Yeah.
In China's case, China is doing well in terms of trade, right? More and more countries are trading more and more with China, irrespective of what I said about investment being in question, right? Like China's still doing well in export markets. The last thing that's changed is that China is becoming the biggest exporters of cars, right? Very quickly, right? So they're still competitive in those types of sectors and in new sectors, but it's just a trade issue, right? If you look at broader financial markets, there's no evidence that the Chinese currency is becoming a substitute for the dollar. In fact, capital is coming out. Even like I advise central banks around the world, right, that manage their currency reserves. And there was a couple of years where it was popular to put some Chinese currency into your currency reserves. Yeah. Even for the central banks that typically plan very long term, that trend has stopped. So it's very broad based. All types of market participants are kind of getting second thoughts on China. So they're still in the lead in terms of grabbing market share in terms of certain traded goods, but they're losing market share in terms of like financial assets. So you can look around the world, right, in terms of emerging market flows, right? The key destination for emerging market flows is now India, right? So this is a big shift, right? If you compare China and India 10 years ago, like there was no comparison at all. As with a lot of things in financial markets, like there's a thing that nobody would have predicted almost 10 years ago, and now it's happening, right? So we often have trends that are hard to predict. And obviously, there's been a lot of things happening since then, but the conclusion really is a major, major shift in those flows. And China is the biggest loser there on that front. And in terms of the equity flows, India is the biggest winner.
Yeah, great. I mean, that was my next question, kind of where you see capital flowing now.
Yeah.
Particularly EAM capital. I guess you're saying that's going into India as opposed to China. Aside from the kind of worsening macroeconomic situation in China, which is directing flows to an alternative, which, as you say, is India, what are the kind of key tailwinds driving capital into India, irrespective of the China argument?
Well, so there's some powerful anecdotes, right? So Apple want to make their phones in India, right? So that's a pretty powerful one. There's a demographic argument we just made, right? I think also, if you think about Western companies that want to diversify their supply chains, they're probably more comfortable with what is happening in India, right? We do have a democratically elected government and so forth, right? So it's a different proposition. We also have lots of people available, and many of them have tech skills and so forth. So I think India is a very powerful story in that regard. In terms of investors looking globally, right, it depends on the asset you have in question, right? There's also a lot of focus on Mexico, in that it's close to the U.S. market, right? And if you want to avoid being exposed to a supply chain where everything is centered around China, you're going to have a supply chain that's focused on, you know, Texas and Mexico. Like, there's incredible amount of trade. There's the supply chains are very interlinked. So that's another one. I think in terms of the capital flows, those are important, right? So if you kind of split it in you know, portfolio equity, like the stocks that we trade day to day, right? Clearly, India is the focus there. In terms of foreign direct investment, companies that are looking to diversify their supply chain, some go to Mexico, some go to Vietnam and other Asian economies. And then there's bonds, right? So the Chinese bonds have fallen out of favor, and they now have competition from a lot of different bond markets. It could be the U.S. Treasury market, right? Even the European bond markets have some yields, or there's some other Latin markets have very, very high yields now, like the highest in a couple of decades. So there are lots of alternatives. It's a totally different world we're in now compared to the ones where lots of yields were zero and 2.5% bond yields seemed like high one. So everything's flipped on its head.
Yeah, it seems like that. And we were talking about data transparency earlier. What's the situation for data transparency in India? Like, is that significantly better? Is it a step change from what you get out of China? Or
I think in India, I think there's less concern about the data being, you know, manipulated, right? So there can certainly be areas where there's a shortage of data, right? But I think there's more trust in the data that does exist. I think also in terms of governance and so forth of companies, there has been you know, Western influence in India, right, for historical reasons, right? That probably means that accounting and so forth is more compatible with what investors are used to seeing in the big developed markets, so-called developed markets.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jens. That's a really interesting insight to end on. India, the place to watch. We'll obviously continue to look at China over the next coming weeks to see what the central regime do there. But I think that just leaves me to say thank you very much for coming into the office and having this conversation with us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the tea.
No worries.